Hey, everybody, and welcome back to our podcast on statistics for the social sciences. My apologies for this episode being a little bit late. I have been under the weather and was hoping not to have to record with such a scratchy voice. If it sounds a little off, I apologize. I am trying to get a little healthier so it doesn't sound so crazy on audio. But anyway, that being said, we do need to talk about research and statistics. So today's episode will talk us through the research process, taking us through all 7 steps that you'll see listed in the slides for this week. On that note, please do open those slides, make your way to the week 6 roadmap page, and we are looking at the slides on research process. The conversation today is going to take us again through all those steps, making sure to define concepts and terms that are relevant, and to really explain what it means to build a research paper. A lot of folks have never had that kind of conversation, but just been told, hey, write one. And I don't think that that makes a whole lot of sense without explaining what our expectations are. So we're going to do that. And as we walk through each of the steps, I'm going to ask you to be practicing the application to your specific research question. So throughout this episode, I want you to think about, what is my research question? How do these concepts relate? And I will specifically ask you to pause and write those things out. Even better if you go ahead and email what you've got so that I can take a look and let you know, yes, that looks like a testable research question. Those look like good hypotheses, and these will make great contents for your initial draft. I'm also going to spend a few minutes at the end talking about the midterm exam and the structure, because that's laid out a little differently than I've done in the past. And if you've heard from people who've taken this course before, we're not going to be using the same approach. So I want to make sure we're all on the same page about how that will look. And then you can always, of course, email me with any additional questions or concerns, and I'll be sure to get back to you as soon as I can. All right, without any further ado, let me begin. And we're going to start at step 1, where we are proposing an initial topic and developing our research question. On slide 4, you can see how the general process for this works. We start out with something pretty general, right? Like a generic topic, something big and broad. And we tend to narrow it down to something that we want to know more about, a question that we can actually get an answer to through scientific processes and statistical testing. Now, this is important. A testable question has to be one that you can answer through, again, a process of, let's say, comparisons or truly doing a test. So did you improve your spelling scores? That can be tested. We can find out if you did as a result of, again, whatever process we use to help coach you on your spelling. A lot of testable questions are going to ask the who, what, when, where, how. But that's not the end of the conversation about testable. Testable is largely about us having an explanation for something and testing whether that explanation holds up and really does account for what we think is going on. So you see the example on slide 4, where is there any evidence that violent video games increase violence in teens? Testable question. We can look at exposure to violent video games, and then we could look at the behavior of teens and say it is or is not more violent. These are going to be questions that are not, let's say, philosophical questions, such as what is the meaning of life? That is not a testable question. It's something that, again, we have to be able to kind of offer a yes, no, and an explanation to. So that's what I'd be looking for with your research questions. Is it something you can test? Asking about whether there are increased rates of mental illness due to COVID, testable. Asking whether foster care leads to worse outcomes for children who have that experience, testable. Asking about programs in prisons and whether those help people or not, testable. Asking how do you feel, again, someone should live their life, not so much testable, philosophical. And those are pretty big, important differences. So if you're asking a should question, I would say let's back away from the wording around should and let's think more about, again, who, what, when, where, how. And some of that is going to be confusing, but that's part of the process, is working through refining your question, narrowing it down, and making sure it's something you can get a true answer to through processes like research. If you're feeling unsure at this point as to whether you could test your question, I'd encourage you to email it to me and let me give you some feedback. But I think from what I've seen for most of the course members, you're fine with what you've written. We may be narrowing down your question a bit, so I'd encourage you to look at your independent and dependent variables and say, okay, maybe instead of mental health or mental illness, are there specific diagnoses that I would be interested in, like anxiety disorders or depression? That helps to narrow it down and to focus our questions a little bit more. If you're asking about all people, are there actually certain age ranges you're interested in or subgroups within the population, let's say students versus working class adults, right? Maybe that is a way to think about narrowing down your question and making sure it's as focused as possible, which is actually going to set you up for success with the next step, which is creating your literature review. A literature review is really just a summary of the existing research on your topic. So hopefully people have written a little bit about what you're interested in. They've done some studies and you can use what they've learned to help set up your paper and your pursuit of what you want to know on the topic. The process of creating a literature review is essentially just learning about your topic. You start kind of, again, big picture. What are the theories, aka the explanations for what's going on with your topic? So last semester, I had a student who was interested in NFL teams and what led them to win the most. And there were some arguments about, well, okay, a lot of teams ran the ball. It was the rushing game in the 1980s, this kind of powerful big dudes running down the field and running through people. But in the 1990s, the 2000s, the 2010s, and more recently, we have more people throwing the ball. So the passing game is more effective at helping teams win now, whereas the rushing game was more effective in the past. That's an explanation, a set of theories around what helps NFL teams to win. So I want you to think of a theory as just a very basic explanation, connecting your independent variable, like strategies for winning for NFL teams, to your dependent variable, actually winning for NFL teams. So start with the theory, and then I would recommend you do some general reading about your topic. Things in the news are good. And then let's get into some more, hopefully, academic studies. Academic studies I encourage just because they're going to apply the scientific process. They're going to be hopefully clarifying their concepts, and they're going to explain what methods they used, aka what was their study design, in order to examine that question. And I think these are really good for giving you solid ideas about how you could approach your research question. Now, I want to take a beat here and just very quickly note, you are not expected in this class to do independent research. Okay, repeat that. Repeating that because it's very, very important. You are not expected to do independent research. So I do not want you to go out and do surveys or interviews or contact your friends and ask them to do some sort of test, right? Like, that is not the expectation for this course. That is something we could do. But generally speaking, we want to make sure that when we do research, it's ethical and we follow all the right guidelines. And that would mean in this class, we'd probably have to look at going through what's known as the IRB or the Institutional Review Board before we did any of our research. That process takes too long, to be honest. It's very quick here at Wayne State College, but it would still hold us up in terms of creating and writing our papers. So please do not, again, do not conduct any original research. We will either find real-world existing data for you to work on for your paper. We might have to modify a little bit what you were planning to look at versus what you look at in the data analysis. Or I will create a fake data set for you to work with. But please, for the love of everything out there, do not go out and ask people about sensitive topics like mental health, drug use, anything like that. Do not do that for your protection and for the protection of the people that you would be talking to, because there's this crazy thing in the legal world where doing research can actually land you in a court of law if you learn about certain illegal activities. We want to avoid that at all costs because we just want to make sure that we're doing the research we need to for this class, which in this case is no independent research. We can base our research and our results on what other people have done, or for the purposes of the final paper, we can just use a fake data set to kind of get the answers that we might expect to see for our research topic. All right, let's say you've already started doing research on your own. You didn't really think that that was going to be something you didn't have to do and you expected to do it, so you've already got the jump on it. Now's the time to stop. I don't want to make anyone feel terrible about anything or really hold you up in terms of being a researcher in the future. Research is awesome. It's super fun to conduct, but there's a lot of potential penalties going back to people doing really bad research in the past. It's got nothing to do with us today, but experiments done in the past often were incredibly unethical. And so we now have a lot of protections in place to ensure that research is done the right way to protect people's rights and to make sure that they have the ability to say that they don't want to participate and they don't feel pressured to do that. So again, we're going to avoid all of that for right now. But if you have specific questions or concerns, of course, contact me. We can talk that through. Just don't worry about conducting surveys, doing interviews, doing experiments. None of that is expected for this course. So don't feel like you need to, and please don't do them. And again, let me know what concerns you have. Okay, let's go back to the literature review conversations. So the purpose of the literature review is summarized on slide 7. And the whole point is to truly describe what other people have already done on your research topic. We want to know, what did they ask? How did they understand or explain what they expected to find? What did they actually learn after doing their research? And then how did they go about doing that learning? And that's covered in points 1, 2, and 3 on slide 7. So start by telling us what research question or what general question was being asked in that source. Some topics are pretty new, so they won't have a whole lot of, let's say, academic or research studies on them. It might just be something talked about in the news or on professional websites. So let's say you're really interested in like forensics or like the CSI kind of approach to criminal justice. Very interesting, but there's not actually a ton of studies out there because doing that kind of research would mean we have to go through, again, jumping through a lot of hoops, having exposure to maybe a lot of things that we shouldn't as researchers that belong more in the criminal justice realm. Or maybe what we'd be doing would actually be potentially threatening to the people participating in the research. Think about, let's say, conducting research on prostitution. You're actually investigating people engaged in criminal activity. Do you honestly think they're going to want to tell you what they're doing? Probably not. So sometimes we've got to look to non-academic sources because the research from an academic perspective just wouldn't be there or wouldn't be possible. And in that case, it's perfectly fine to use something like news sources or other credible sources that can talk about your topic. Credible here means trustworthy. So credible includes you knowing who wrote whatever resource you've got. The author is clearly identified, and the author is someone who either through education or experience knows what they're talking about. It's gotta generally be trustworthy in terms of it lets you know where they get their information, whether it's from that person's experience or from statistics that they find, from research studies that they find. Do they show you where they get their work from, through a works cited list or a references list? Those are the hallmarks of something that's credible. They know what they're talking about, and they make clear what information they're using to support whatever perspective they have. Now, that doesn't mean we don't necessarily run into problems of bias. Bias is when we run into an argument that selectively only uses certain evidence, doesn't maybe consider the whole picture just to support their own perspective. So this is why I'm going to say I don't really want you to use sources like blogs necessarily, unless the blog is from an expert who truly is making clear everything that they're arguing and looking at maybe all sides of a topic or a range of different resources. I'm also going to encourage you to stay away from specific sources like, say, company websites or attorney websites where they're largely trying to market their skills. It's not that these folks aren't experts in their area. It's that the purpose of those resources is not to educate or inform. It's to persuade you that this is someone who is very, let's say, good for you to work with. And that means they're only going to present limited things on their resource, again, probably leading to bias. My best recommendation for finding credible sources is to, again, use academic research sources, what people would call like peer-reviewed journal articles. That's good. It's also great to look at news sources that are credible. This could be the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the New York Times, sources like that. And professional publications, let's say from the American Academy of Dentists or Obstetricians or something like that, those are largely credible resources that are going to, again, make clear who the author is. It's probably going to be somebody with a lot of experience in the area or education in that area, which means they generally know what they're talking about. And they're also going to tell you their resources. What did they use to help them understand something? If it's an academic study, they should be telling you how they got their information. What method did they use to conduct their research? And that's point three on this list. How did they go about finding what they learned? Did they do surveys? Did they do interviews? Did they conduct experiments? Did they have people sit down and do writing samples of something? How did they find out what they learned as a result of their research? That's actually point two. So first thing, make sure that you are getting the research question or what people were asking about, what they wanted to understand. How are they saying that it will work? What's their theory? Explaining maybe the relationship between the independent and dependent variable of interest. What did they learn? What did they find? If it's a news source, what are they saying is kind of the major or main point that they're expressing to you? And then how did they get there? What were the research methods that they used? Or how did they learn what they learned? Did they talk to experts? Did they review laws? What is getting us to that outcome? And you'll need to do that for all five resources in your literature review. You need at least five, and I don't go beyond that because I want you to spend time finding the best resources and the things that are most relevant and pertinent for your specific question. So try to find resources that really do talk just about your independent and dependent variables. And that'll help a lot in writing an effective and very focused literature review. Following that research process, we need to come up with our plan for how we're going to do our research. And this is crafting your study's design. So study design, how do you plan to do it? What is your actual plan? And I've given a really like kind of creepy example, at least for me, because I have this unreasonable fear of clowns stemming from when I was a child. So slide nine, goes through, well, let's say I want to do research on clowns and fear. Am I going to survey people and ask them what their feelings are? Am I going to sit them down and make them watch a scary movie and measure whether they start crying or shaking or just can't watch it and have to turn it off? You know, this stems to my actual fear of clowns. I saw the movie It when I was far too young, and I wasn't even watching it. It was literally just clips of the movie, but I promise you, it was enough. Me and clowns, we are not friends. So you could also do something like just have people look at pictures of famous clowns like Ronald McDonald. Ask them to tell you how they feel. These are all study designs. They all are examining ways that there's a relationship between clowns and fear. So there's no really one perfect study design, no one specific thing. But I will say this, if you do experiments, people find that that has a lot more of the internal validity where we can say, yep, there is a cause and effect relationship here, and we can, because we're controlling for everything else, we know that whatever in the experiment was changed is really causing that. So if we had an experimental setting where we put everybody in the same kind of conditions and then we showed them clowns and we could show an increase in fear and nothing else had changed, we could say, yeah, the clowns are causing the fear. So experiments allow you to do maybe that a little more effectively, but for most of us in the social sciences, experiments aren't always the most reasonable way to do our research. And sometimes that would, again, straight be unethical. If you think that you're going to terrify people with clowns, nobody's going to approve that experiment. So again, all different ways that we could carry out our research plan. That is our study design. And that's something I want you to describe in the data section of your initial draft. For that initial draft, you're going to be talking about essentially what type of data you would ideally have. And we're going to get real with the final paper where we talk more about what's in our fake data sets or what's in the real data that was out there in the real world for us to use. But for the initial draft, you can kind of run wild with it if you had no limits on money and time. What data would you get and how would you get it? And I'd love to see that in your drafts so that we can think about, well, what would best fit with your research question that maybe we could find that's already out there? Okay, moving right along. We have our research question, our literature review is written, we know what our study plan is, but as part of that study plan, we need to specify how we're measuring things, particularly our variables. So we need to begin by naming and defining each type of variable. What's our independent variable? Or if we've got more than one, what are the independent variables? And then what are our dependent variables? Or if there's, again, only one, just the variable, we need to explain them, define them, and describe how we're going to measure them. You would also include any confounding variables or things that you think might influence both your independent and dependent variable, things that might affect your understanding of the relationship between those two, or just things you think are really important to keep in mind that, again, we want to understand those effects as well. So one of the examples in correlation was GPA and parents' socioeconomic status and your friends. Well, if we're trying to figure out all the effects on GPA, we want to measure both of those other variables and find out, okay, what's their relationship to our dependent variable? The process of spelling out our measurement is a couple of steps. First, we have to decide what level of measurement we're going to use. Is it going to be nominal, where we just have categories? Is it ordinal, where there's categories, but there's a ranking to them? Is it interval, where we're using numbers, but it doesn't have like a zero point that has any meaning? Or is it ratio, where zero is literally the starting point? And then beyond levels of measurement, we need to figure out what are our units of measurement. A unit of measurement is essentially the levels or quantities that we're using, or maybe even the categories. So they're pretty standardized, meaning it's common. Most people use it this way. And units, if we're talking about something like time, can be like minutes or hours. They're really fixed spaces between each unit. So 1 hour is the same difference to 2 hours as 2 hours is to 3 hours. This is kind of thinking about that ratio and interval measure. But units can also be weird with like nominal categories, where we could be talking about like race being white, black, Asian, Native American, Alaskan Native. We have a bunch of different categories we would include. And that way we cover all of the categories and our units are comprehensive. We have everything we need to allow someone to choose the racial category as how they self-identify. Something like age, we measure in months or years. That's pretty easy. Something like sex, we often measure as male or female. But in the social sciences, as we have more conversations about what transgender is, we may need to think of different ways of measuring this. We want to make sure in social statistics, we are adequately and accurately tracking how people self-identify if we're asking those kinds of questions, because it can and may affect our results. Now, let's say I'm looking at something like feelings. Well, feelings, I could use a scale. So 0, I never feel that way, or 10, I always feel that way. That is the same thing in terms of we've got units of measurement, we've got kind of these fixed spaces between them, or these standard spaces between them, or these standard categories. Those would be our units. So I want you to be thinking about and take a moment to pause and say, okay, I'm planning to measure my independent variable as nominal, ordinal, interval, ratio, whichever one fits. And then what would be your units of measurement? If you're looking at men and women, are you going to do male, female, and additional categories, or just male, female? Are you going to, if you're doing race as a category of interest, what are all the different racial classifications that you should have listed? And also one quick note, race and ethnicity are two different things technically. So when we say race, we tend to mean something different than Hispanic or Latino, which although that often gets counted as race, that's more about ethnicity. It's a little complicated, so I won't go too much further down that path, but if you have questions about the way to measure your independent and dependent variables, let me know. And then I do also want to say for a lot of dependent variables, we do things like count a number of incidents. So how many times were there a certain type of witnessed behaviors from someone, or how many times did, in the research that I do, how many times did a person return to prison? These are counts, and counts would be ratio variables. We would just be, again, counting the number of a certain thing that we're interested in. So keep that in mind as you figure out your units of measurement. And one additional point of clarification, this came up in a past class. You don't need to have all types of variables or include all types and all levels of measurement for your paper or project. It's just whatever fits for the research question that you're asking. So if you're asking about, let's say, different political affiliations, which would be nominal variables, and how much does that affect, let's say, someone's participation in voting, which would be a ratio variable, how often do they vote or how many times have they voted? I wouldn't also try to do ordinal and interval measures. I would just stick with my nominal for my independent variable and ratio for my dependent variable. May sound weird to have to say this, but someone did ask in a past class, do we have to have all of them? No, you absolutely don't. So that is part one of measurement. Measurement being, how are we actually going to measure our variables? Part two of our measurement step is drafting our hypothesis, or the expectation that we have in terms of the independent and dependent variables. Apologies in the background for Woody. He's getting all sorts of worked up about this hypothesis testing. So a hypothesis is actually a statement that we use to guide our research, looking at slide 16 here, which is in a lot of ways like a prediction, except we're going to phrase it not quite the same way. So the statement to guide research, getting 8 hours of sleep makes for more productive employees. We're going to look at how many hours of sleep people are getting and how productive they are. Rather than saying if an individual gets 8 hours of sleep, then the individual will be more productive, where we're literally going to project something onto a person. We're going to do more of the generic statements where we're looking at the relationship between the two. That said, research and hypothesis testing is not as straightforward as one would think, because we have a whole bunch of different types of hypotheses. Looking at slide 17, we have a research hypothesis. That's what you actually think you're going to find when you do your research, so what you expect to see in terms of your independent and dependent variable. And that could be non-directional or directional. And then we could also have what's known as a null hypothesis. That null hypothesis is actually what we test in our research. So I need to do some talking and clarification on all of these points. Let's jump into that now. Okay, research hypothesis. We are clearly talking here, again, about your expected relationships, which means at its core, your research hypothesis is really just a statement of what you think you're going to find in your research question. If we take the examples I've used for myself with, let's say, programming and returning to prison, My research hypothesis is that there is a relationship between programming and recidivism, or return to prison. And I can be directional in that hypothesis, or I can be non-directional. The way I've said it was non-directional. I simply say there is an effect. But directional would say, okay, well, what type of effect? Well, let's think here in terms of what I'm talking about with my research question. That's going to read like there is a positive relationship of programming as far as reducing inmate recidivism. So more programming leads to less recidivism or lower return rates to prison. It's directional because I tell you how the direction of one leads to a change in the other. It's not simply that it has an effect. That is truly non-directional. This is the type of effect. It's one way or another. It increases something or it decreases something. For your research papers, you're probably going to offer a directional research hypothesis where you say, this is what I expect to find. Foster care has more negative outcomes for children later on in life, or mental health has specific effects as a result of screen time. These things we're saying have a direction, right? One increases or decreases the other, or it pushes it in one direction. But non-directional is the best type of hypothesis if you're just trying to figure out if there is any relationship whatsoever, and you don't have a reason to expect it moves one way or another. So, interesting example from a prior semester, a student's testing a research question on whether people in the United States or people in France are more likely to have beliefs, strong beliefs in particular, about the existence of aliens. Do we have a reason to think that the United States versus France should have more of those effects? I don't know of too many, other than maybe alien conspiracy theories or alien thoughts and evidence might be more discussed heavily in the United States, but that's not exactly the most strong reason to say there's a cause and effect relationship between location and belief in aliens. So in that instance, a non-directional hypothesis would make a lot of sense to say, well, we believe that location might have an effect on whether someone chooses to believe in aliens, does believe in aliens, is very strong in their belief of aliens versus not. However you feel about aliens, it's all good either way. I just wanted to use that as a pretty clear example of maybe we don't have a good reason to think of a specific relationship between our independent and dependent variables. Now, quite separate from a research hypothesis is what is known as the null hypothesis. And a null hypothesis simply says there's no relationship between our two variables, our independent and dependent variable. And confusingly, the null hypothesis is what we actually test when we do research and use our statistics. We're testing if there's no relationship. Because if we find a pretty extreme value on that test, we can say, but there's something else going on here. There is a relationship. And maybe that relationship points in one direction or another. But the truth is, what we test in all of our research is what's known as the null hypothesis. We're saying there's no relationship. So when we find some extreme result on our test, think, you know, out in the tails of a normal distribution, something extreme on those ends, that's going to mean, hey, something else is going on here. That's a little lead into our next conversation about probability, which connects the normal curve with statistical tests, but I want to put that in right now so we can start thinking about it that way. Some examples of null hypotheses show up on slide 19, and you'll notice it's simply saying there's no effect or no preference if we're talking about the cat food example. Cats show no preference for food based on shape. So food preference is not affected by shape. Or the middle example, plant growth is not affected by the color of the light. Or age does not have an effect on musical ability. All different versions of null hypotheses. Right now, I'd like you to pause. Go ahead and take a minute and write out what your research hypothesis is for your research question. And remember, you're just saying here, what is the relationship you expect to find between your independent and dependent variables? And then try to write out your null hypothesis. It's a little bit different than trying to write the research, but focus on simply saying there's no effect. And do practice writing it out. It's a little confusing the first couple of times you do it, so I want you to just give it the old college try and see how it goes on your own. And then, of course, send it to me so I can give you some feedback on how it looks. All right, we are more than halfway through our research process to the stage of data collection. So data collection is going to be where you put your study design into action. So if you planned to do surveys, this is when you actually go out and do the survey. You ask people the questions and you collect their responses. Same things with interviews or focus groups, which are group interviews. That would all constitute what's known as primary data collection. And primary data collection is when you get the information the first time. You're not taking it from someone else's research, from existing reports or existing studies. You're collecting truly new data that no one else has collected before, which is great. But you can also often use data that other people have collected where you don't have to work quite as hard usually to get what you need to do your research. That's called secondary data collection, where you take what others have already written or existing data sets and you use those to try and answer your question. That again can come from different reports or existing data sets. And there's quite a few of these in the social sciences. Think of the General Social Survey. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that, but the General Social Survey is a very long-running and extensive data collection project that's been going on for some time. Or you could even use things like census data, which is collected by the government to report out information about the population. That is all the kind of existing data sets that would be excellent for use in your final paper, if you can find them. If you can't find existing data sets, again, remember we are not doing original or primary data collection for this project, so we'll figure something out in terms of a fake data set that I create for you and that you can use to successfully complete the paper. Now let's just say, for the sake of expanding on this discussion, that you are going to be doing primary data collection. Well, that primary data collection is going to be where you draw a sample from a population, like what you see on slide 22. A couple of important things to keep in mind about a sample. First of all, you see that all the members of this sample come from the population. We must draw our sample from the population that we're interested in. So if I want to ask questions related to something that women are thinking, my sample should not include men because my population of interest is women. So only draw the sample from the population that you're interested in. And then on slide 23, there's a nice little visual of what it means to have a representative sample. A representative sample simply means it accurately represents the population or the breakdown in the population. So the graphic shows at the top what our population breakdown is and then what our sample should look like. Our population on this slide is 75% female and 25% male. So to have a representative sample, we need to have that same breakdown or proportions in our sample. And you should be thinking about this with respect to anything that might really influence your results or your findings. So you might be thinking about race and ethnicity or age or religiosity, right? Maybe education level, maybe political affiliation like Democratic or Republican. If these things are going to be something that might have an effect on your outcome, you should probably think about them in your sample and try to create a sample that represents the population accurately with respect to those properties. Getting a representative sample is important for a couple of reasons, but the biggest one is simply that if we have a representative sample that looks like our population, it means that we can actually take what we learn about that sample and apply it to the population, or in other words, we can infer things about the population based on what we know from our sample. This is captured in the term known as generalizability, and that's pictured on slide 24. So if our sample is valid, it's reliable, and it's representative, thinking here about all of the terms that we've talked about with our data, validity, reliability, and on that last slide, it's representative. That means we can actually take our results and apply them to the population and know something about the population without having to study the entire population. There's a bit more on statistical inference on slide 25, and it's just more explanation of that word infer and what it means. And large scale, this is the scientific process. If we do good experiments with small numbers of people, we can still learn a lot about people in general. The same holds true for any other research approach, like surveys, interviews, or looking at maybe large scale data sets. If we have good data, then we can learn a lot about our population just by working with a smaller sample. And the reason for working with a sample is simple. We don't have the money or the ability to generally talk to or study or experiment with an entire population. Too much time, too much money, it's just not possible. So if we can learn effectively about a sample and apply that to a population, we will have really effectively learned without having to invest a huge amount of time or money into our research process. Okay, take another pause. And right now, I want you to be thinking about what data, what specific things statistically would you need to answer your research question? What would you need to gather, or what would you need to have available for you from existing research to look at your independent and dependent variables? And shoot me an email on that. I'd really like to have that check an email from you just to let me know what you think you need, and maybe we can develop some plans for existing data sets that are out there in the real world that could line up really nicely with your question. Okay, rolling into the final two steps of the research process. So we've collected our data, we've done all of our work of specifying how we're measuring everything, and we've gathered all of it, and now we do data analysis, which is cleaning, transforming, and modeling data to discover useful information. So we're looking at our data. This is a great time for you to start working through some of, let's say, doing descriptive statistics. Look at those calculations for the mean, the median, the mode, the standard deviation, and the variance. Let's create some histograms. Frequency distribution. Remember that table listing all of the values in our data set and how many times they show up. Use the histogram to visually present that more as a graph. And on that note, let's do some graphing with your data. One of the best suggestions I ever received in my entire time as a student was in my PhD program. One of my advisors was like, "You must look at your data. If you don't look at it, like seriously graph it and visualize it, you're missing a big part of the process. Because when we look at things like data, we can actually see trends that sometimes doing advanced statistics won't effectively really address. So take the time to model your data. Take the time to create a histogram, a frequency distribution. And for a sample, start looking at those descriptive statistics. Those are incredibly important for us to understand our sample and its makeup, and then to think about how that applies to a population. The last step, and one I didn't even actually create a slide for at this point, is where we do our interpretation and our conclusion. Once we've looked over our data and done our analysis, we can offer an answer to our research question. Did we see the expected relationship we thought we would see, or did we see something different? What do we know from our surveys, our interviews, our existing data sets, and the kinds of statistical tests we've done to look at our question? Are our people in our sample telling us something important about the population, or did we find something we didn't intend to find? All of these questions are really important and things we need to offer our thoughts on as we wrap up our research paper and our research process. And I'll be looking for that in your final paper, is that you go through each of these steps, although you structure the paper a little differently than the way this is laid out. Make sure you look at the paper guidelines, specifically the guidelines for the initial draft right now, and start working on it. Begin writing your background and your introduction, and then jump into the literature review. Find some existing studies that are on your topic and your variables of interest, and start summarizing those pieces. And if your topic is not something that's really written about in, let's say, academic terms, start looking for news stories or professional publications on them that are going to help give you insight into your variables and how you can answer your research question. And keep it focused on that, always focusing on how can we know more about the things I'm asking about in my research question. Once you've done those two sections, you'll need to craft what's known as the data and hypotheses components. And those are a little more challenging, but they tie in very well to what we've talked about in today's podcast. So make sure you're taking the time to do that. Again, focusing on that initial draft for peer reviews. It's not due for some time, right? But I want you to really focus now on the background, the research and literature review, and definitely the hypotheses. The data section, go ahead and just answer the questions. The questions there talk about, is it something you plan to collect on your own or use from an existing data set? And as I've said, we're not going to do original research, so if you would like to collect it on your own, go ahead and say that in this paper, right? I would have preferred to do that, but because I know we can't do original research, I will just be working with Jenny on creating a fake data set. Make sure you answer all of the questions thoroughly and hit all of the points in each section, and you'll do fantastic on this initial draft. Okay, that takes us through the material for the slides and descriptions of what to do in the initial draft, but we still need to briefly touch on the structure of the midterm exam. The way this exam is going to work is you will have two parts to it, and each part will be timed. So you'll have 75 minutes per section of the exam. Part one is going to cover measures of central tendency and variation, and the discussion of things like graphing and data visualization. Part two is going to cover correlation, including things like reliability, and what we haven't talked about yet, our next episode on probability. Now, the setup being in two parts means you can take one part early in the week and the second part later in the week, and that's just fine. But both parts need to be completed by Friday of midterm week. And I would ask that you use an honor system here. I know that this is an online course. There's not too many things I can do to totally shut down your access to outside sources. But the point of giving a test and grading a test is to assess how much you've mastered the material. It's not to see if you can look things up online in rapid format or if you can, let's say, get an AI system to actually answer the questions for you. I'm going to try to structure it so that it's not quite that simple. But that being said, I'm going to rely on you to, again, be honorable in the way you take the exam, trust you, and let you know that for each part of the exam, you can bring in one sheet of notes. I don't really care how you structure that sheet. You can print it front and back. That's fine. If you feel like using size 3 font to get everything possible on there, also fine. I would just simply say, make sure that you only use that one sheet and answer the questions to the best of your ability. Please remember, if this was being done in class, I would be restricting your access to any online sources. So it's honestly best if you don't do that. You just open up the exam and answer to the best of your abilities using your notes. That really does let me tell you how well you're doing with mastery of the material. Another important point about the structure of the exam is that each section will have two questions, but you only need to answer one question per section. So in the first section on measures of central tendency and variation, you're going to answer one of the two question options. This will be listed in the instructions, but I want to emphasize it here. So in 75 minutes, I'm asking you to answer two questions, which you should anticipate means the questions are going to be more of an essay style or essay format. In order for it to be completed in 75 minutes, of course, we're not talking about writing pages and pages, but you should anticipate this is going to be a bit of a more lengthy essay type response. In which case, what I'm going to be asking is not simple and straightforward as far as just calculate an answer. It's going to be more about analysis. So I want you to think about questions that would be asking you to do more analysis, and think about maybe the week 5-6 check-in sheet or the week 7 review sheet, and how do those perhaps set you up to think about additional questions you might be asked on the exam. All right, so we've covered basic structure, two different parts to the exam, two sections per part. each section kind of following under that general heading of measures of central tendency and variation, then graphing and data visualization on part one, and then with part two, correlation including reliability and probability. So 75 minutes for each part. Both parts need to be submitted by Friday of midterm week. You can use one sheet of notes per part, meaning you can do different sheets of notes for each portion of the exam, and make sure that you don't use any other outside resources as you write your responses. Multiple questions per section. You only answer one question per section. So overall, for this exam, you'll be answering four questions, which means they're going to be weighted pretty heavily as far as points go. Take your time, think about it, and as you prepare, remember, I'm going to be asking the types of questions that line up with, let's say, the week 5-6 check-in or the week 7 check-in worksheets, as well as what you identify on the slides. The slides are your best preparation tool for the exam, but of course, you can always contact me as well, and I'm happy to send you any additional guidance that I can provide. And at this moment, I think it's time to go ahead and wrap up this podcast a little longer for a single episode than maybe what we've done in the past. But I think it's done, hopefully, an effective job of covering how to write a true research paper with all of the steps fully explained. Please, of course, email me with any questions or concerns you have about any part of the slides or any part of this podcast, and I will get back to you as soon as I can. All right, everybody, have a great rest of your day, night, week, weekend, and I will connect with you again soon.